Gaddis, the bottom of page 68. There were long periods of inactivity at times, even boredom, as if each side was waiting for the other to make a move. I only had three tasks here, Mal later recalled, complaining to his startled hosts. The first was to eat, the second was to sleep, and the third was to shit. Finally, though, Mal let it be known that he had come to Moscow, not just to celebrate Stalin's birthday, but to discuss substantive issues. The Russians responded by asking for suggestions. Mao proposed a range of options, extending from a joint communique, emphasizing friendly relations, to an outright military alliance. Stalin quickly chose the latter alternative, but Mao then further delayed matters by insisting that his prime minister, Zhao Enlai, come to Moscow again by train to negotiate it. After some difficulty in pinning the cautious Russians to a firm commitment, Zhao at last emerged with a formal treaty obligation obligating the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China, in the event of an attack on either by a third party, to come to each other's assistance. The purpose of the alliance, Mao cabled the Central Committee in Beijing, was to prevent Japan and its ally, presumably the United States, from invading China. The Chinese, in turn, would be able to use the Sino-Soviet Pact as a big political asset to deal with imperialist countries in the world. Mao thereby made explicit in his invitation to a still wary Soviet Union to expand its influence in China for the purpose of deterring the Americans. This is not to suggest that he intended for China to become a Soviet satellite or anything like that. Mao at no point was prepared to yield control of either to his party or his country to anyone. Nor was the evolving relationship with the Soviet Union without difficulties. The atmosphere during his meeting with Stalin has been described as both electric and indeterminate, with both leaders in a constant state of alert, searching out hidden meanings and potential traps in even the most innocent remarks of the other. Nikolai Fedorenko, Stalin's exhausted interpreter, recalled an almost physical sense of danger hanging over my head. It is clear now, though, that the Truman administration's assumptions that Mao should logically fear the Russians more than he did the Americans and would therefore welcome opportunities to improve relations with the United States were incorrect. The Sino-Soviet Treaty of 1950 was what Mao wanted. It was in no way imposed on him, as the Soviet Union's alliances with its East European neighbors had been. It was a means of discouraging what Mao believed to be an immediately dangerous adversary by seeking the protection of another great power that might someday become a danger, but was not right now. In this sense, it had an analog in the North Atlantic Treaty of April 1949, in which the West Europeans had invited the Americans to guarantee their security against a feared Soviet invasion. Both commitments were a form of extended deterrence, put forward with some reluctance by the superpowers involved, and certainly with a good deal of worry about the expenditure of resources and the danger of war they might bring about. Both were provided, though, out of a concern that not to do so, and thereby to risk the collapse of allies, would be an even worse alternative. Both are directed against the threat of an attack that was in fact remote, if it ever existed at all, but statesmen operate on the basis of what they believe at the time, not what historians may conclude decades later, and it is not exactly unprecedented in the history of empires for them to act, whether by imposition or invitation, to relieve improbable or even wholly imaginary fears.